Welcome back to Label, the stories, rumors, and legends of Tooth & Nail Records. I'm your host, Matt Carter. And today we have a really interesting, slightly different type of episode with Lee Humarian, who was the drummer for Phineas for nearly a decade. He's a very classic stereotype of a Tooth & Nail kid who followed his passion for music and energy and mission for God. And Lee was drawn from music into missions full-time, landing him in the Ukraine in 2014, where he and his family made a home and a life there, you know, during all the escalating conflict over the last few years. And I felt like it was a great opportunity to have this conversation and get the perspective of someone from our world on another world that seems so foreign and unimaginable to me. And this conversation is both fascinating and powerful and heartbreaking. And I'm glad to introduce you to a special person like Lee. And I hope you get as much from the episode as I did. And I'm already rolling here. And so sorry. Good to go. But do you have any familiarity with the podcast? Did you hear the Phineas episode?
I did. So yeah, once Adam connected with me, I downloaded that one. I actually started listening to it back when it first came out, and I think I started watching it on YouTube or something. It's on YouTube, right? Or is that
some stuff?
I just remember Sean like posted a link, and I started listening to it, and then I listened to the whole thing once after Adam hit me up, and so yeah, it was awesome. It's awesome to just hear. I don't know. Like Sean's so funny. I feel like you guys sped up his voice though, because he was talking so fast.
Yeah, I speed people's voice up.
It always makes me laugh when
I keep mine slow. I speed other people's up so they sound silly.
Because I remember Sean. I don't know, interviews he's done recently. Like we still stay in touch and everything, but seeing him, I don't know, he's grown. It's great. All the boys have.
Did you feel when you were hearing it, you felt, you know, connected? It felt like you connected in a way?
100%, man. Like, yeah. I mean, obviously I've known him, you know, he didn't mention this, but I was thinking about it as soon as he was talking about As Cities Burn. Cause he had said like, you know, I know old drummer Lee would agree, but we met in our first semester of university. And I had like an As Cities Burn shirt on. And I think I was like drumming on the desk or something. And he was just like, yeah, was that As Cities Burn shirt? So that was where we had that connection. Neither of us were in the band yet. Little did we know, you know, that first connection a couple of years later would, you know, we'd be basically family at this point. So
that's pretty fascinating. Because I always think about these bands that get together, and you know, sometimes there's bands that don't have as many talented people or whatever, but a lot of times it's just a collection of talented people who, how do they find each other? How do they grow up down the road from each other? And there was that many people
right
that close together or something. But the way that bands find each other is really fascinating. And it's really crazy when those first connections are to stuff like that, like As Cities Burn, or, I mean, it's the simplest things like playing drums on a desk and then everything unfolds from stuff like that. It's pretty, pretty wild.
It's insane, man. So I'm thinking back on that memory and like, you know, he was just like, yeah, that sounds pretty good. Like, you know, you play, obviously. And for me, you know, I'm just like, I don't even realize I'm doing it. So I just was like, oh yeah, I love drumming. I've been drumming since I was 7. And As Cities Burn was actually my first, like I went to the Dead Poetic show in Slow Brew, California, in San Luis Obispo, California. And that was like, As Cities Burn, I think, was the opener. And I don't think I had ever heard of them at that point. And, you know, obviously bought their record, bought a shirt that night. And that, you know, that's been one of my favorite records since that moment. So, cause that was, they were touring Son of the Love, Your Darkest, cause TJ was still in the band at that point. So it was the first time I had heard. And it was, I would say, some of my first exposure to like live. You and Sean were debating like what style As Cities Burn is. I also don't, I'm not sure I don't know what I would call them, but I just remember feeling like the drumming was just so interesting and just being really drawn to that. And the whole, all the music, like they're just such a dynamic band that I just really enjoyed the dynamics of the drumming, but in the dynamics of the drumming within the music and the songs as a whole. That was just really, really fun.
Yeah, I make fun of their drummer all the time because he's a good friend of mine, Aaron Lunsford. But he is a really good drummer, and I hope he hears this because I even make fun of him playing drums and stuff like that. But not only is he a good drummer creatively, like he thinks of things that are, you know, he's got just intuitions, he feels things and he thinks things, and he has a great connection with Cody. So he can interpret Cody. He's Cody's interpreter in a lot of ways. Like he could pick up what is in Cody's mind in a way and express that as well. So he's, you know what I mean? So it really, once you get somebody that can have a talent like Cody, who's just some common extreme talent of some type, you got to surround those people with people that can tap into it and amplify it further, you know? And so that's one of those really good relationships, you know, at least in a musical way, you know? So
100%. Well, and I mean, my philosophy as a drummer has always been just support the rest of the group. I mean, especially Phineas was always a guitar driven band. You know, I never wanted the drumming to overshine what everything else that was going on. I just wanted it to just bring everything else up and just kind of be as solid as a backbone. And so, that's cool to hear that sounds like what Aaron's kind of, what he was really good at, was what he was really skilled at, is doing something similar, just taking Cody's brilliance in songwriting and just kind of taking it and just bringing it to another place. And, you know, it's just beautiful. It's beautiful when you have that kind of, you know, synergy when bandmates are feeding off each other, and it just makes the entire sound, the entire song, just that much better.
Yeah. And drums is a crazy instrument because it's so expressive. And it seems like, you know, I guess part of the stereotype of this whole scene and who we are, were these people that couldn't sit still in school anyway, you know, and wanting to play drums, and it's the loudest. So there's a lot of people who are attracted to that drums or get to play along with the drums or whatever. Like, but the drums, you know, represent a lot of probably what attracted all us to this loud music. And, you know, a lot of drummers in our scene have taken drums to, you know, new levels. I think if you think about Jesse Smith and Aaron Gillespie, and, you know, there's just drummers out here that are in the lineage of truly great greats at the thing, because they just get it on an energetic level. And then, and there's something, I don't know, there's something special about that. And it's something is lost in traditional music talk, music school, regular recording industry, or music production basic, where everybody's talking about, like you said, serve the song or just do this or that or whatever. But what I'm suggesting is that Cody's mind is special, and Aaron is not just listening to the sounds that come out. He is knowing Cody. Like, you know, there's a connection that's more than just, he's feeling the feelings and the passion or the confusion or the complexity that's in Cody. You know what I mean? And so that's what's even cooler, is that's the next level of some of these things that come out. And, you know, some of the stuff I just think is kind of special or on the extremes of our scene is in there.
Dude, absolutely, man. And when you can understand someone that deeply, I mean, you can really feel it as a, you know, back then, I mean, you know, I didn't know anyone obviously in the scene at that point, but you can feel like, I feel like now I could feel that connection in the music, you know, I could feel that in the drumming, like, especially, you know, obviously that record is so dynamic, and in the slow parts, like you feel, I don't know, you can just feel the drums just really support, I feel like, the emotion that was trying to be conveyed. Mm-hmm. And it definitely, I don't think it at any point gets in the way at all. Like, it just supports it beautifully. And if even like at times, even just deepens the kind of just the real dynamics and the real emotion that album has. So yeah, I mean, mad respect. Cool. To,
yeah, them. And I gotta say, they played at Labeled Fest this last year at Furnace Fest, and we got a full audio and video capture of that. I haven't released it yet or finished mixed the audio, but it's very special. Like, when I look back at the tapes, like, oh, they blew everybody. I didn't watch their whole set that night, but it blew everybody else away from what I see so far, including us as the headliner. But it was a real moment was happening. That whatever it was, it had that specialness to it. So, and we got it you know, a good capture of it. Yeah. So eventually when people see it, you'll know what I'm talking about. But it's a cool, cool performance. Come on!
I'm excited to see that myself.
We're way into talking about, you know, deep stuff and the scene stuff and Tooth and Nail Kid. We already covered a lot, but let's tell me some more Tooth and Nail before we get into our even broader, bigger topics. I'm curious still more about what you hear in your solid state Tooth and Nail background of yours.
Mm-hmm.
What other bands are the things that were landmark to you?
For sure. Yeah. I started drumming when I was 7, and that was just like, we went from this very conservative Baptist church where my mom was the choir director, and she wanted to introduce like drums and acoustic guitar. And of course that was huge no-no. And so we were like, we gotta find a place where it isn't a no-no. And so I remember the first Sunday we were at this new church that my parents are still a part of to this day. And that's been, gosh, almost 30 years at this point. So. I remember first Sunday, I just fell in love with drums, saw this drummer. He turned out to be a drum teacher. And anyways, I feel like I've always, like, the drumming in music has always been incredibly attractive to me. And so, you know, when I first heard like MXPX and Dogwood and these drummers that are just like drumming so fast and just really aggressive. And just really fun. Like, it was really fun. That's like, I just wanted to start drumming like that. So I started getting into like some more like punk rock, like early on. And then once I think, my friend Dan introduced me to Beloved, and that was the first thing. He was like, "Hey, this is kind of punk rock, but it's like even heavier. It's got these breakdowns. I think you're going to love the drumming." Boy, was he absolutely right. I mean, that's one of my favorite albums to date. You know, I think it's pretty timeless, and the drumming is just so fun. Like, it's just, and it's crazy that like Joe's also doing the screaming. Like, it's insane, man. So all of that, like, to me, it was just so fun, and it just inspired me. That's when I first started like thinking about double bass and started thinking about, oh, like doing these breakdown type stuff. I'd never heard anything like that before. And so that was definitely a gateway album for me into just the whole like hardcore scene, metalcore scene, metal scene. Like, started listening to like The Darkest Red by Agony Scene is one of my favorite drumming albums ever. It's just so raw and aggressive and just like insane. Like, some of the stuff he's playing is just like,
did you ever see it live?
It's crazy. Never got to see them play live, unfortunately, which I'm bummed about, because I've, you know, watch some recordings, some videos of them live, and it looks like just the craziest show, like so aggressive, so insane. And so, yeah, those kinds of like, and it just inspired me as a player, just to like, I want to be able to play this like double kicks work stuff. I never was good at double bass until like wanted to as a kid, never was taught. Like, my drum teachers were, you know, not old people, but, you know, older, or like, you know, adults, not playing double kick in the way that these guys were, you know, in that at that time. And so never really learned it at all until basically Phineas's, you know, when I was at university in Southern California with Sean, Phineas's drummer was leaving the band, he was graduating and leaving. And I was like, oh, if I want to join this band, like I really wanted to, I got to be able to play the stuff. So that's when I remember sitting in my dorm room. I just put my double kick pad. I bought like DW 9000s on Craigslist. They were like old and beat up. And I just set up like a towel on my desk and just was doing double bass on my desk. And it was just probably annoying the entire dorm because I was just hours a day just trying to like learn how to play with my left foot. And so still, I would say not great at double bass. Even, you know, that was definitely like a crutch of mine because I played for years without it. And so it wasn't, I started learning it at a place where my brain was already a little bit further developed than it was when I first started playing. So definitely not as good at double bass as a lot of the kids these days, but.
Oh my gosh. Still. It's so crazy how good people get once they turn it into a game or a sport. I didn't think of it that way. Coming in at some points, like music gets more and more technical, but the fact that it keeps getting technical and technical and the new kids come up and they can see YouTube and watch it and learn it, the bar is higher. Like there's people doing things technically that I mean, it's just nonsense to me. I'm not even going to listen to that because I could see how it go farther and I would be like an old person that said it sounded like noise, but it already goes, like, I'm never trying to play that fast. What are you, crazy? Like, I don't have in my mind, I just have no desire to do it, but it's because I can't.
Right.
Yeah. I can't do it.
And I'm not trying to put in the effort to learn how.
So that solidifies my taste right there. But the agony scene, I really would like to figure out what episode to make with one of those guys or about that band. But when they first came out, was right when we were new and around, I think. Yeah, right at the same time. So we did an early showcase with them. We did a couple of Seattle dates in like a tiny little bar with them. We did one show where we got to be the local opener for Norma Jean right before we had a record come out. And Agony Scene was on that. I think it was who else was on? Somebody else really good was on it too. But that drummer, and I forgot his name. Do you know his name?
I don't recall. No,
I don't remember his name. But it was just, I'd never seen anything like that. Was a new category of drumming when I saw that in the room. And that was a long time ago. That was 2003, I think. And it was, it was just that. I mean, that band is really, really neat. And, they just had a weird career and stuff like that. Maybe ahead of their time in some ways. Whatever. But, very cool band. I'd like to do something on them, but so that's very cool. Beloved, and that you skimmed over the pop punk stuff, but that even that was about being fast before you had that super double bass. You just blast whatever you can do fast, same attraction.
Exactly. Yeah, and that was like, I remember just trying to do everything with one foot, like listening to MXPX or listening to Slick Shoes or listening to Dogwood, and just it was all about just playing as fast as you could. I don't want to say those drummers, that's all that they were thinking about, but obviously punk rock is you're just playing those fast beats. You're doing the double roll with your foot and stuff. And so it definitely helped like just my overall, I guess the fundamental of like playing fast with these three limbs. I didn't get it with my left foot, sadly, but, I think that was definitely fundamental for my just initial kind of like growth into that style. Like, I don't know, never really thought about playing a punk beat, before listening to, I remember my friend Jared Scott. So he's like MXPX's photographer now, but he was like my youth leader back in church. And he was in a punk band in our hometown. And he introduced me to MXPX and I just loved it. And just, I think my first album was MXPX at the show. I think it was live from Chain Reaction. And that it's like 20 songs or something crazy, but it's just all their bangers. And I just remember listening to it and being like, I don't even understand what this guy's playing, and then wanting to understand it, wanting to learn it. And there wasn't YouTube back then. There wasn't like a way for me to watch. I feel like I learned best by watching, observing, and then like consuming. But it was just like listening and just trying to understand what is he playing. And it's not like the most technical things, it's just, it's fast and it's fun. But as a young drummer, like that was just super fun for me to just try to dissect and pick out and learn and just figure out how to physically play that fast, in a way that's like not going to kill my body. So that was really fun.
So you're a Tooth and Nail kid in all the, stereotypical ways, even with 100%. The mom as worship leader of the church, semi-restrictive church, you have every single ingredient. So you're a prototype here. And the thing is that one thing I think special is it's there's a little bit more passion in our music, and our music's known to be passionate and compete in those passionate realms. And, I think a good amount of that is that's where Christianity actually helps when a lot of times people say Christian music's worse. But when you pair it right with the right people and the right motivations, it is extra sauce, you know, that you're passionate about both things and putting them together as hard and fast or loud or extreme as you can, that is special. It does really make something unique. So when you take those two passions, though, for you, I don't know, I'm curious the story of being in Phineas and then not, and actually following the passion into this, you know, complete the ministry. You know, you don't hear that part of it when you're pulled away from one to the other. Is kind of a unique story. And then, you know, all the way to be here in this Ukraine and Russia war stuff. So, which I don't know anything to do other than ask you what is, you know, I just follow my curiosity from here. But that's what just really fascinated me about the opportunity to do this conversation. Just like, okay, this is somebody who took a different path, but yet follow the same part of the formula of the passions of a tooth and nail kid. And, you know, here you are doing something interesting with that. So that's what I want to fill in here. And I really don't, you know, I really don't know anything about the story or anything about what's happening it geopolitically, but look, catch me up.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, it's, I loved being in Phineas. It's like one of the fondest times of my life, super formative years. Love all the guys, was privileged to play with. I mean, especially the final lineup, you know, which is the lineup I toured with most, with Sean, Bryce, and Dan. Just some of my closest friends to this day, you know, and even some of the old dads, you know, Glenn and Ryan. And anyways, really formative time in my life. And really, I would say, you know, Phineas was kind of created to be a light in a pretty dark scene. I mean, I would say, you know, at that point, metalcore was still like Phineas, gosh, started way before I joined it. And so it was, they started the band right around kind of when everything was starting to spark, you know, Killswitch. And, you know, definitely we get a lot of Killswitch comparisons. We get a lot of As I Lay Dying comparisons. And so the band was created to really be like a light in a scene that, you know, doesn't have a lot of light necessarily. A lot of metal bands aren't singing about, they're singing passionately, but not necessarily about, you know, the brightest things, obviously. And, you know, we just wanted to be a band that went into that scene and wasn't like afraid of it as a group of Christian guys. And so, I that probably sounds really like token and cliche, but for me, I was very personally like serious about wanting it to be a ministry, you know, and kind of thinking of it in a missional way, and tried to be intentional, like, you know, even from the start when we were a local band for years. And then once we started touring to when we started, you know, actually touring album cycles and things like that, I always tried to make a point of being present with people, not just, you know, kind of sitting backstage or whatever, but being at the merch table, having conversations, trying to be a genuine human, you know, and a genuine follower of Jesus, and trying to love people like Jesus. And so that was always our heart as a band. And Sean, every night from stage, would like tell people that Jesus loves them. And it was just simple, no matter what tour package we were on, whether it was a, you know, all Christian band, or whether we were the only one, whether we were in America or when we were, you know, touring Europe and other bands are talking about, you know, singing about hating God. And we would try to be bold in a way that was not like, in a way that was just trying to express the love of Jesus. And so we always took that very, very seriously. And so I feel like there had always been this kind of missional mindset. And even, you know, we started touring in 2012, like full time in 2012, and I got married at the end of 2012.
Why does everybody get married the year their band blows up and start touring? Why does everybody do that?
Dude, it's, it, I remember, seriously, man, like I remember doing, I think we did something stupid, like 8 weeks or 10 weeks in that summer. And it was so brutal on our relationship, my relationship with Katie. And, you know, that was, we kind of had a come to Jesus moment, like at the end of that tour. I remember driving, literally it was like the last day, we're driving home from New Mexico. We're all exhausted. And, we get a tour offer to like support War of Ages on a tour in like October or November. It's like right when my wedding date is. And I remember being just like,
so
are you serious, dude? Like last day, haven't connected with my wife and, you know, like haven't seen my wife in like 10, I can't remember how long it was, but I call her and she's just like, come on, dude. Like, And I'm like, you're right, man. So I got to fill in for that tour. I played the couple like California shows, but you know, it was like, yeah. So anyways, all that to say, like we, but you know, people would always ask me, you know, cause I toured for five years after, you know, being married or whatever. And, you know, I obviously guys do that all the time, but people would come up to me and be like, how do you do it? How do you leave your wife for a month or whatever? And we like very seriously I would tell people like, well, I feel like I'm called to like be married to Katie. I feel like we're supposed to be married. We also feel like I'm supposed to be in Phineas. So I'm called to Phineas and that God is calling us to these two things. And if that's true, then God will be the bridge between us, to use a Phineas line. But you know, that God will provide what's needed to continue to thrive, even though we're, you know, living a long distance relationship half the year. And we really believed that. We really lived that. And I loved it. Katie got a job as working in high school ministry at a church in Southern California called Fullerton Free. And she was on staff there for 2 years. And one of her jobs was to lead a summer missions trip abroad. And for like several years, the team or the high school trip, it's just for the junior class going to seniors, they had gone to Ukraine and they had partnered with this organization called Josiah Venture. She was brand new to the job. So she was kind of like, well, you know, they gave her the choice. Do you want to do the same trip that's been done several years? Do you want to try something new? And she was kind of like, that doesn't make sense to change something. Like, it seems like it's a great trip. It seems like the organization's awesome. It seems like the kids love it. The parents love it. Like why change something that actually looks awesome? And so, that was our first exposure to Josiah Venture, the organization that we work for now. And we did a short little like 3-day pre-trip because we're taking like 20, 30 high schoolers to Ukraine. We've never been. We don't know anything about the trip. So we went ahead of time. And we went to Ukraine in 2014 and we landed 3 days after everything crazy happened on the Maidan Square in the capital in Kyiv. And that was when there was a revolution. They ousted out the Putin puppet that was the president at the time. And then that's when Putin then invaded Ukraine the first time. And so that's when the war started, was actually way back in 2014. And we were there in Lviv. And it was crazy because like so many people in the city were gathering in the city center. There was just candles everywhere. I mean, Orthodox priests and, you know, Christian pastors were all on this stage that had been set up and leading just like hourly prayer. Wow. And it was just like really incredible to see. I mean, all the like walls between, you know, different denominations and even, you know, all this stuff were just totally, everyone was unified in that moment of just saying like, no, we value freedom. This is actually, I'm wearing this is the Ukrainian trident, Ukrainian symbol. And it has the word volya in Ukrainian on it, which means freedom. And it's just like this really deep value. Ukraine's only been a free country since 91. So literally it's a younger country than us. Mm-hmm. And yet it's been through such attrition in that time. And especially since 2014, when Putin initially invaded, we were there for a few days. And that was, I always say that we felt like that's when God was starting to like gently lay like a maybe future call on our hearts. Like we came back from that trip being like, man, that was awesome. Maybe one day we'll do something with Josiah Venture, you know?
Wow.
And so because of that very war, we ended up having to go switch our trip. All the moms and dads of our high school kids were like, please don't go to Ukraine. We felt totally safe and thought it would be fine, but we understood their concern and ended up talking to the organization. Ended up going to Czech Republic that summer to do a camp, which is where I am now. Loved that. Wanted to go back to Czech Republic the next year. The leader of the next year's trip, we thought it would be a no-brainer for him to invite us. Actually, we had initially got invited to lead the trip, and this other guy got brought on staff, and it was his, actually, like, it was supposed to be his role. But we thought, oh, we're veterans now. Well, he'll invite us to be leaders. And he didn't. And we were devastated because we really wanted to go back to Czech. But now we look back and we realize that God was actually like kind of saying, no, like you need to not give your hearts to Czech. Because the following year, 2016, we got to lead a trip with Just Adventure to Ukraine, to Odessa, Ukraine, to do a fusion camp, which is like a music and arts, it's like a rock pop choir band. Got to teach these teenagers that had never picked up drumsticks in their life. In 1 week, they're picking up drumsticks for the first time. A week later, they're playing their first concert. Like, they're playing pop songs. They're playing.
You are blowing, you've blown my mind on two things in this last just answer here. And I had to slow down to get them.
Sorry, yeah.
The first one is, okay, so I just really was curious, like, you're in a band, like that's the dream. So how, I was like, how would you go this other path if you were on this path where you're doing this thing that you've been passionate about since you're little. But when you explain that scene in Ukraine, the first time you go, you're like, you've been at Chain Reaction playing shows or whatever. And now you go over here, but the environment that you came into was an even more high energy kind of crazy thing happening. You said those pastors in the streets and the praying, and it was like, that's how you described it. Was like, I went, and it sounds like this crazy intensity of a bunch of gathered people that care about faith and connection and other people and accepting everybody, which is the same values from our, you know, that's the same. Oh, everybody's welcome, but we just want to get together and everybody's welcome here because we're all doing this thing that matters. And then you find a similar one, but that matters even more because the consequences and stakes are obviously real. But it seems like it's that same high energy kind of thing. And so no wonder you attracted and kept wanting to do it.
Dude, that's a great observation. I had honestly never, ever made that connection in my head, but it actually makes a ton of sense that, you know, the thing that I loved about touring was the people and the togetherness and getting to, like, you know, have, for whatever reason, you know, have an impact in people's lives, you know, and it's just really beautiful to want to make, you know, that music and shows can actually make people's lives better, you know, and having an interaction with somebody can be so real and raw and just can improve their life. You know, I think, you know, one of our teammates here in Just Adventure, Terry English, he always says, like, every opportunity every conversation is an opportunity to open the door to the gospel or close it. I feel like it's so true. Like every interaction when I was touring, I wanted to, like, add to someone's life. And there were certainly times on bad days when I certainly did not. And I'm sure there's people out there that think I'm a big jerk. And I probably was to them on a day and on a bad day, you know? But yeah, coming to Ukraine and seeing, yeah, I mean, just seeing the unbelievable passion, but also like you said, the stakes are so high, right? It's their freedom. It's like they wanted a free country, and people, I mean, there's people that died during that revolution that fought, you know, just freaking police, like, you know, president guards, like, shot them just like in the square, you know, in Kyiv, not in the city where we were, but in this capital city of Kyiv. And like people died, but literally there was 1 million Ukrainians in Kyiv, in the capital, like protesting what was that, you know, like insane. And that's just, the stakes are just incredibly high. And unfortunately, now again, here in 2022, you know, 8 years later, the stakes have become even higher, you know. So it's just pretty wild.
So yeah. Attraction to intensity and danger. Just like somebody's got a bit, you know, the stakes are real for real. So some people have to be attracted to that, to, you know what I mean? So it's just, and then also the other thing that's blowing my mind, just kids and music. So, because that is a, you know, really a fundamental thing. And the way you describe that is that they get those breakthroughs so quickly. Like, if you think about when you got into music and when you were at the age where you could have breakthroughs and just learn so much so fast when you first are playing drums or learning how to hear harmony or whatever it is, you know, like you can just go so far so fast. So, you know, that's pretty gratifying, you know, as well.
It's exactly what I always tell people. Like, imagine you know, you pick up their drumsticks and a week later you're playing your first concert in front of your parents, from your grandparents, from your friends. Like for me, it's like, I picked up, I was seven when I started playing drums. I played my first concert when I was like in my 20s, you know, like it's literally years. Like I was playing at church on Sundays and things like that, but literally like, that's insane to me. And imagine like if they succeed, like that experience will be with them for the rest of their life.
Oh yeah. It'll propel, it'll give them tons of momentum.
Exactly. And, you know, I would say, you know, couple that, like just that incredible, like creative growth. And then we're also, you know, partnering that with spiritual growth and what we believe that Jesus has to offer. And it's just camp, you know, the Fusion Camp is just an unforgettable week where you're just growing in crazy ways. And, you know, we also do like English camps, and it's the same idea of just like, let's help you, let's get some native speakers to teach you how to speak, you know, speak English at a different level, you know, and that's, it's just so powerful. Like, and, you know, this, that just music is just, it's simply powerful. And, you know, the challenge is always, you know, it's a week and you're teaching a kid and you're teaching eight of them, because we play eight songs in the concert. And if, you know, you got to just, in the first day, you got to be like, okay, do they have rhythm? Can they hold the sticks right? You know, like you got to just kind of analyze, and then you got to realize, okay, I think you'll be able to, in 7 days, you'll be able to play a simple, you know, four on the floor beat. Or you can say, oh, you actually have rhythm. Maybe you haven't played before, but you could do something a little more complex, you know? It's fascinating, man. And it's happening. Drums, electric guitar, bass guitar, keys. I mean, it's happening. And then you get the Fusion kids that come and they, because we do a Fusion camp, but then we have weekly Fusion rehearsals during the semester. And so we have semester concerts and summer concerts. And there's one kid now that's freak. I'm teaching him my old songs. I'm like, he's like, I want to play, you know, and he started at a Fusion camp, just started playing. You know, got inspired, loves metal. Like he wants me to teach him like Lamb of God songs. And he's always, there's a Ukrainian metal band called Ginger that he's just like, you know, he just wants to be a metal drummer so bad, you know? So I'm just like, I have a blast teaching him, but it's insane.
That's so crazy. I never thought of that and putting it all together and how that all works. And you're just, you know, you're just elevating people on a bunch of levels and using music because everybody wants to focus on it. Yeah. And I'm curious about the conditions there. Is it some, you know, I think, why am I not doing that here in my neighborhood and stuff like that? But I'm guessing there must be something, in which I probably should, but is there something about them are less distracted or have a different, I mean, obviously come from a different place than 7-year-olds here, aren't maybe so interested? Like what is the circumstance in which you get that much focus and determination from these kids to obviously buy all in to like go so far in a week? I mean, what's the environment that helps that?
Totally. Well, I think one, there's the pressure. It's like, hey, we're playing a concert and they don't want to fail, right? I mean, they want to succeed. But I also think that, you know, so in Ukraine and in a lot of Central and Eastern Europe, like music lessons, like casual music lessons just aren't very popular. Like if you want to study music, you go to the conservatory and you study and you become a, you know, a professional, you know, that's kind of the mentality kind of the, and so, so for a lot of kids, the reason it's the first time they're picking up drumsticks or a guitar or anything is just because they've never had the opportunity to go to just like a music school or just go to like a music store and, you know, ask for a lesson or something like that. So it's becoming more popular where casual, you can get more casual lessons or, you know, you can pay a teacher to come teach your kid piano or guitar or things like that, but it's just rare. And all, and you know, the average income, there's not a lot of disposable income for the average family. And so paying somebody, you know, to teach your kid an instrument just isn't possible for a lot of families. And so the fact that we can offer, you know, not just free lessons, but actually like we have quality musicians that are teaching your kids, you know, obviously it's the very, very basics at first. We can't teach like theory in a week, but if they continue to be present and we continue to teach them, kids can actually get pretty good, pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, you get kids that just want, that's like, they just want to learn, they're passionate about it, and they see the opportunity and they take it. And certainly there's teenagers that, you know, I mean, they're still teenagers. They still have phones and YouTube and they're still distracted a lot of the day, but there's definitely some of the creative kids that, man, there's this one girl, her name's Nastya, and you know, she's like a wild card. She's playing every instrument. She's playing bass, she's playing drums. And I remember our first summer when we moved to Ukraine, she was at one of our fusion camps. And I taught like, I thought 15 or 16 kids that week. Every song had like two drummers, two drum sets. It was bananas. But I remember the first time she had picked up drumsticks. That was in 2017. And then now this semester, she was supposed to help me teach, you know, 5 years later. And unfortunately, like we had literally on February 23rd, we had our first fusion rehearsal of the semester. And then February 24th is when Putin escalated his war in Ukraine and invaded in a totally massive scale. So I was really looking forward to equipping her to teach other teenagers now that she's, you know, she's a young student now in college and stuff. So, but that, like, when they're present for 5 years like that, you can see, you know, them come from literally like first time to, you know, it's so cool to see that journey. And then also see them also want to give other people that experience. Like you're trying to, you know, equip them. You know, we talk about in our organization, like make disciples that make disciples from the harvest to the harvest. Like we want them to not just grow in their skill, but also grow in their ability to, hey, why don't you do what I, you know, why don't you take my role and you do it? Like you'd be great at it, you know, and you speak Ukrainian way better than I can at this point, you know, so why don't you like
take so a you couple, give them the musical the language and then they'll take the put it into the verbal and then multiply that. And you, discipleship is really, it's probably also just quite inspirational. Like you're here and you've never seen this before and all of a sudden this other kid here, and the kid probably feels so proud, and then other kids want to learn from there, and they just so it, you know, if you not, it's just that's amazing. That it sounds like a I'm curious about the I could linger here forever. I'm just, but I guess I should probably be. I'm curious about the just the you know analysis further of what the situation is like from my point of view, like from your point of view, if you could expand more on like the way you explain this, an escalation of something that started in 2014. So you're speaking very clearly and have a good point of view. So tell me more about what is the, you know, what are we experiencing here? How should somebody that like us, you know, look at what we're seeing here and trust what and listen to what we trust you absolutely. Because we know you're like us.
No, it's, yeah, I'm thankful to be a voice if I can be, you know, an advocate for Ukraine. Yeah, so, you know, essentially in 2014, you know, there was a president that was essentially a Putin puppet that Ukraine was able to oust like successfully. There was a successful revolution. But, you know, Putin really, I mean, he's kind of an older person now. And it seems like he's a little bit, I mean, maybe a lot of bit demented in kind of his thinking, but he really kind of has this dream of like reuniting the former Soviet Union, you know, which is not just Ukraine, but it's also the Balkans, Estonia, and you know, it's pretty insane. But in 2014, the start of the escalation was, you know, he annexed Crimea, which is kind of this vacation peninsula in southern Ukraine. So he came in and just said, this is mine now. And then he also invaded parts of eastern Ukraine, kind of right that border Russia, and that war, like that war, has not stopped. Like it's been going on since 2014. But in Crimea, he annexed it, and there hasn't been fighting there. But in the east of Ukraine, it's called the Donbas region, which is like there's a Luhansk Oblast, which is like county essentially, and then there's the Donetsk county or region. And so those two regions, they've had fighting since 2014, and people have been dying almost every day, but not on like on a very small scale, you know, which it's still death, but you know, like they're just shelling constantly, you know, and it's just insane. So, and then, you know, there was kind of all this like weird flexing that he did for like a year, like way back last, you know, last year, back in 2021, he started just kind of positioning troops along Ukraine's borders. He was kind of up near Kyiv, kind of down, you know, just, he was kind of, and he was telling his army that you're just going to do drills. You're just going, you're doing military drills. They went into Belarus, which is like up north of Ukraine, and we're doing drills. And, you know, constantly telling the world that I'm not going to invade. As early as, you know, mid-February, he said, like, you guys are crazy. I'm never going to invade this country. And then, unfortunately, you know, we woke up. I remember vividly waking up, because in kind of mid-February, when things were starting to escalate, at least verbally, our team, we kind of have a crisis response document. So it was kind of like, hey, we're gonna go to a new level of crisis here and start meeting every morning on Zoom. We were praying together, we're reading a psalm together, and just kind of talking about the news and what was going on. And I'll never forget February 24th, waking up. I woke up early that day, 5 a.m. And I had from the start of the year, I really wanted to have depth in my morning rhythm with the Lord, which is just 20 minutes of meditation, then time reading the Bible, time praying. Had a great morning. Hadn't looked at my phone at all. You know, hop into this meeting at 6:30 or 7:30, I can't remember. And at 7:30 a.m., hop into this meeting and hadn't looked at my phone, hadn't looked at the news, and they're all just like, Putin's invaded. Putin started bombing Kharkiv, which is northeast Ukraine. We have a fusion there at a church that I've been to several times. He started bombing the city. There's videos of, and I'm like, oh God, what's going on? I open my phone, look at my Twitter feed, and I'm just seeing like not just military targets getting hit. I see residential buildings, apartment buildings that look very similar to ours getting bombed. And you see that, and they had that first day they bombed and they launched missiles to several different like strategic like airports and just kind of blew up a bunch of airports. And some of them were not too far away from home. They didn't bomb Lviv, our home city, the first day. But, you know, a couple hours drive south and, you know, Ivano-Frankivsk, like they had bombed there. They had bombed north of us. And so seeing, you know, now it's not just isolated to this one little small part of East, you know, southeastern Ukraine. He has escalated in a crazy level. They're coming down from the north to try to take Kyiv. And so seeing all of that, you know, we have two little kids. We have a 20-month-old and a 3-year-old girl, 3.5-year-old girls. You know, me and Katie. I remember like we stopped the meeting at probably, you know, 10, 15 minutes in, because air raid sirens started going off in our city. God. We started hearing, you know, sirens going off.
But so you're in those moments, you are feeling, your body is feeling a physical fear, like a nervousness of your physical, like on some crazy level that was very like real.
Yeah. And it was such a stark contrast. I had this incredible morning, not looking at my phone. And I mean, at 5 a.m. was when everything happened. So I literally woke up, and had I looked at my phone, I would have immediately sensed all this. So it was just this stark contrast of feeling like so at peace to all of a sudden feeling so unstable. Like there's just
the air raid siren was because of, you know, it was for you to alert you of possible bombs coming for you. Like that was the siren you're hearing.
Yeah, it was like get to a bomb shelter.
Ugh. Wow.
Like, and so essentially what happens, and air raid sirens are constantly going off in all of Ukraine. The reason is because, you know, they fire missiles from the Black Sea, which is like south of Ukraine. So they'll fire missiles from the ships. And, you know, initially you don't know where they're going to land. They're just, you know, they're going up And so basically all the cities kind of in that region are just, hey, we don't know where they're going yet. Get to safety, get underground, get into a basement, get into a bomb shelter. And then once they get to a certain point when they understand, okay, it's unfortunately it's this city getting hit, but this city, they do an all clear siren so that you can go out of the bomb shelters. And so that was the first experience. Yeah. And what's crazy, man, that was like early in the morning. So that was a Thursday morning. That's my wife usually has her language lesson. Right down the street, there's like a 5-minute walk. There's a McDonald's, and our language teacher, bless her heart, she's a grandma, but she's, you know, one of the best Ukrainian teachers. She's like written the book, How to Teach Foreigners Ukrainian, and she's our personal teacher. It's incredible. But she calls us, you know, at like 7:40. So the sirens hadn't been going off yet. She calls us. She's like, hey, for some reason, McDonald's closed. So I'm going to just come to your house. You know, I'm just going to walk over. And we're just like, we had seen the news at this point. So we're like, Ludmilla, you know what's happening, right? And she's like, oh, it's just a test. It's just, you know, she comes in, you know, our building doesn't have an elevator. So she walks up 4 flights of stairs to our apartment, you know, and at this point, air raid sirens are going off. And she's just like, I think it's just a test. You know, she doesn't have a smartphone or anything. So she hadn't heard the news yet. And so we're just telling her like, nope, it's not a test. Like this is real, you know? And that was, what was insane was she was still kind of not convinced yet. And so she's like starting the language lesson. So she's like, here's your homework, Lee, that you turned in on Monday. Like, here's the mistakes you made. And I'm just like, my heart's racing. I'm like you said, I'm in this moment of like fight or flight mode. You know what I mean? Like, my mind's racing. Like, what do we do? And she's just like calmly like correcting my homework. You did this wrong. Like, you know, and I'm just like, what is happening? So I was thankful she was there because she was able to kind of just explain to us, you know, she speaks Ukrainian to us. She's explaining to us like, you know, what the sirens mean, what this means. You know, she was just kind of able to kind of help. Just nice to have a Ukrainian presence to help kind of calm us down that moment where we just like, okay, this is a new experience for us. We've lived here for almost 5 years now. But so, yeah, I was in that headspace. What do? We started packing right away. Like because there was already starting to be an escalation, like we had already packed a bag. We had already filled our tank. Like our vehicle actually has a gasoline tank and a liquid, like a natural gas tank. So both tanks were totally full. We could drive for miles and miles and miles. We had food for 3 days in our car already. We had water for 3 days in our car already. Cause we had kind of speculated if Putin does invade, we might be spending up to three days sitting at the border waiting in line to get out. So we had already had that prepared. But then once that happened, we're like, oh man, we started packing, just packing our bags, packing our girls' clothes. We just like put my computer down, just put on Peppa Pig for our girls to watch. So they were just like distracted and we're just like frantically packing everything. You know, just like we have food in our fridge. It's just like, what do we do with this? You know, like it was just crazy, man. So then once we were seeing residential buildings on day one getting blown up, you know, getting shelled, that was when I just told Katie, I was like, we need to go. Like, we need to leave. And made that call and packed up. You know, carried all of our bags down to the car, got the girls dressed, you know, kind of turned off our electricity, turned off our water, turned off our gas in the apartment, locked it up, and then walked out to our car. And that was about probably 9:30, 10 in the morning. So in the span of a couple hours, we made the decision to evacuate. And the border's about an hour and a half drive. The border. So we live in Lviv. It's the closest big city to Poland. So it's about an hour, 15 hour, 20 to drive to Poland. And even driving, I mean, all the gas stations, by the grace of God, our tanks were totally full of gas because all the gas stations just had 30, 40, 50 cars lined up to get fuel. It was like legitimate panic buying, so we were just driving, we drove to the border and, I'm calling our team leader, Ben, and just, he had called during the process while we were packing the stuff. And at one point, like once we had made the decision, I called him and said, "Hey, we've decided to leave." And he's like, "All right, like, where are you going?" And we were going here to our teammates, Casey and Kristen Yorman. They opened up their home to us in Chesky Teshin, I'm saying that very wrong, in Eastern Czech Republic. But I was calling all the guys that I disciple, all the guys I have one-on-one meetings with, called all of them, just like weeping on the phone, just like, "I don't want to leave. You know, I really don't want to leave. If I was here by myself, even if it was just Katie and me, but we have these,
I can hear girls, you know." Like, what's the reason you would want to, like, you feel there's a duty to stay if you could or something?
Yeah, just, man, I didn't want to abandon our friends, you know, and abandon our local church. I mean, it's legitimate, like, and every single person we talk to, you know, we called our local church senior pastor that we serve with. We called all the people that we're close to. My direct reports, the two girls that work for me, work on our schools team. I lead ministry in schools in Ukraine, and called both of them. All of them were like, "It's the right decision. You're getting your family to safety. It's like, don't feel bad." So everybody affirmed our decision. It's still one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make in my life. I mean, we're driving away from our friends, our church, our ministry, and not knowing when we get to go back, you know. And as chance would have it, I'm going back with our team leader tomorrow to Lviv. So in like 6 hours, we're starting to drive to Lviv, and I'll be there this weekend. And by the time this comes out, I'll have come back. I'll be back in Czech Republic. But one of the hardest decisions we've ever had to make. And
you had to make it quick.
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, we had a contingency plan, you know, and people had been writing us, emailing us for a couple months leading up to everything, because Putin was really starting to, it seemed like he was going to do something, right? But it didn't seem possible that he would do what he did and just invade on a crazy, crazy scale, because it's just madness, you know, but he did. And so, and we also kind of had this kind of threshold where we didn't want to just bail if no one else did. If it was just kind of like, we didn't want to be like, "Oh, foreign missionaries, we can leave." We kind of set this threshold. Like, if our friends, if our Ukrainian friends in Lviv are talking about leaving, mm-hmm. and they're leaving, and that's a sign for us that, okay, this is legit. This is legitimate, you know. And, you know, there's a, because Ukraine is a relatively small country, so no men up to the age of 65 can actually leave the country during wartime. So, you know, so none of my friends have been able to leave the country because they're all in that age range, you know, all my guy friends. And so that there's also that level of like survivor's guilt. It's like, well, all of my guy friends had to stay, but I had to leave. You know what I mean?
Are they drafted or can be, or they might be in the future kind of thing? How does the conscription work?
Yeah, exactly. So that there's a bunch of different levels, and so there's reserves and everything. And basically it's at the level where everyone's called up. But so essentially the guys that are living, that are serving in Lviv right now, there's not any active fighting in Western Ukraine, but if there were to be, then they could get called into action. So, but essentially there's a lot of like, there's even like a huge civilian militia in a lot of big parts of the country and stuff. But right now our guys are all, and I want to say, oh, it's only men. Like some of their wives have stayed. There's some young 20s, couple girls that are on our team that stayed as well, and they're serving. So they're doing like humanitarian aid stuff. We're on this side, we're sending in humanitarian aid, and they're filling up buses and sending them to us on this side, and we're helping them find places to stay, places to live long term and stuff. But yeah, so those guys, like, if there were to be active fighting in Lviv, which by the grace of God, it doesn't look like that will happen at this point. But they, yeah, I mean, they have to be available, essentially. They can't leave.
A lot to take in. Just that, you know, that whole scene is so easy to imagine, you know, from,
yeah,
it's just this, with you telling it this way, it's quite easy to imagine, where otherwise I, you know, I hadn't thought about the practical experience, in that way. What is your sense of what the rest of the world is seeing? You know, like, do you feel that there's a dissonance with what you experience and what your friends back home or other people, how much they care or what they think is happening or not? Is there misconceptions?
I think, as with anything, unfortunately, these days, you know, propaganda is powerful, man. And Russian propaganda is unbelievably powerful, especially when it's kind of been soaking and you don't really realize it for so long. So, I mean, Russia, so many Russians are pro Putin, and we have we have many friends that have family in Russia, like Russian family members, and our Ukrainian friends will call their Russian family and be like, "Hey, Russia's bombing my city right now." And their Russian family members will say, No, they're not. I don't believe you.
Oh yeah.
That's unbelievable. And then a couple of days later, they'll be surprised to be like, "Wait, why are you in the Czech Republic now? Like, what? Why aren't you in Kharkiv?" Because you're bombing us, dude. Like,
wow.
So it's crazy that propaganda is
bombing
that,
us, dude.
Yeah. That's what I would say. That's probably not what they're saying, but. I would say reasonably, you know, United States is across the world. And so from what I've seen, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of obviously what's on the news there, but, you know, I follow a lot of Ukrainian, I follow a lot of American journalists that have been in Ukraine for a long time. And then, they're getting exposure. I would say the war is actually getting, because it's Europe, like, it's sad in one way, because there's obviously, like, there's been a lot of wars that we probably have no idea happened in America. But because this is like Russia, because it has a feel of like World War One, World War Two, I feel like that aspect of it is like terrifying. And so it's getting a lot more press, even Western press, than I would say, you know, unfortunately, than like the war in Yemen, or even the, you know, Russia's invasion of Georgia or Afghanistan, things like that. Like, those things, I don't remember hearing
just
about.
Glosses over most of the time. Yeah. You just, like, well, there's conflict in X, you figured out, and you can't remember put it on where that is on the map. I don't see a lot of videos of those. I don't know, you know, or whatever it is. And you just, you know,
don't think about it. Yeah. It's, you know, I would say understandably out of sight, out of mind, but now, and I mean, gosh, the overwhelming information age, you know, you can't ignore it. I mean, you really can't. If you're connected to the internet, I mean, you're seeing something, you know, something's happening. You know, you may not know exactly what, but, you know, there's definitely, you know, people know that this is happening. And obviously, you know, it's affecting everyone. I mean, because of sanctions to Russia, now gas prices are insane, you know, and everywhere across the world. And you know, that affects everything. That affects supply lines. That affects food. That affects everything. So everyone across the world is experiencing, you know, unfortunately, the consequences in different ways. But I would say, you know, sadly, you know, I see even, you know, unfortunately, I see a lot of, I see a lot. There's some, you know, I'll just say it, like, there's some far right, you know, American journalists or far right American voices that side with Putin, you know, sadly, or at least early on in the war, we're starting to say things like, well, you know, I remember seeing this one person say, like, you know, my faith looks, I resonate with Putin's faith. more than I resonate with Biden's faith. And it's just like, what? Like, you claim to follow the same Jesus I claim to follow, and you're saying, like, what? So there's definitely, like, there's definitely things out there, you know, even propaganda and everything, whether it's from Russia or from elsewhere, or people saying, like, this one little group of, like, these Ukrainian, like, offset part of the army called Azov, like, they're like, oh, Russia has basically called Azov, like, neo-Nazi battalion, essentially. And there's all this propaganda about all these war crimes that Azov is committing. And there, Azov is freaking in Mariupol, which has been under siege for weeks by the Russian army. And if it weren't for Azov, that city would be, it's like 80 to 90% destroyed. It'd be completely destroyed by now, you know? So there's just this weird, it's weird how information is actually a weapon now in our day and age.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how, you know, unfortunately, you know, I mean, we see this all the time, right? Not just in politics, but in everything. Like, you read a headline and you get triggered, you know, from something. And it's just like, information has such power, and unfortunately,
physical effects. You know, it has physical effects on.
It right. does, man.
I mean, that's all you really ever see. I mean, you have five senses or more, but all they do is receive information and process it.
Right.
You know, so yeah, whatever is true or you can get in very much affects your whole reality.
Yeah. And you can kind of create your whatever information bubble you want. Like, I can block people on my social medias that attack my views not even attack them, but legitimately question them. I can follow all the people that kind of have my same, you know, look like me, talk like me, act like me, believe like me. And you get into this bubble, and it's no wonder that people start believing crazy conspiracies and start believing propaganda, because you get fed the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. Like, what do you expect to happen? You know, like, that's our brains just take it in and start to adjust and literally, like, cut off anything that isn't what I'm looking, you know, what we put in front of our eyes every single day affects everything. And if you're,
it's really sad, because there's an unintentional part here where you develop a blind spots from that, you know, and it's not intentional of those people in Russia who think, we're not bombing you. We wouldn't do that. That's not something we would do.
Right.
So that whatever, and then you're getting reinforced the counter narrative, and you don't choose to ignore, you're not choosing or trying to do anything bad when, you know, you can understand how they get that way, or somebody could get far right. I mean, there's bad actors in there, but you know what I mean? You say how people could believe it, maybe not the right purveyors of it, but, and then you get all the way up to Putin. Well, he's completely obviously lost as a person.
Yeah.
Do you know, because of his information diet, it's probably the narrowest of anybody's, you know, he's not getting the right information. That's his problem, is he is not getting correct information,
right,
because of the way that it is, the way he is, the way his mind, whatever it is. But he's acting what seems irrationally, you know, in a lot of ways.
Totally.
But he is doing it.
And he's completely isolated himself. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's a bunch of memes, but like all his meetings with even his like top aides are like, the table's huge, and he's totally isolated himself. And sadly, the corruption, you know, of kind of, you know, the corruption that he created, it, meaning like, I want you to tell me what I want to hear, you know, has actually, oh, totally. Cause it's
corrupted.
His
ability.
Well, his generals are telling him, yeah, your army's amazing. You have all these tanks at your disposal. They're just telling him what he wants to hear. And then he makes this, you know, awful decision to invade. I'm just, you know, like, actually, you know, devastating for millions of people, decision to invade, and is actually losing the war. I mean, think about it. Everyone in the whole world thinks that Russia is the second, you know, has the second best army in the world. And little old Ukraine is dominating. Like, I mean, there, I feel like there's a lot of elements there. I feel like there's probably some spiritual element that we can't see, but like, there's also corruption in training, like versus the Latin. Once Putin invaded, like America, Canada, I mean, Britain, like all these countries have come to Ukraine and been training the military. Like they are getting the right information. They're actually like, they, you know, they understand, they don't have any cognitive blind spots. They recognize there's a huge threat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're little old Ukraine. If we, you know,
open minded,
if we want to, yeah, if we want to, if we want to survive, we need training from the best, and they've received it. Versus, you know, Russia, this, you know, they have cognitive blind spots clearly, and you know, the training,
they have a false confidence or they're incentivized to pretend to ignore flaws or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Because I tell you what you want to hear, Putin, and you give me money. Or you give, you know, you, I have a villa or I have a yacht, you know, it's like, it's so sad, like that level of corruption, but it's now totally coming back to bite Putin and Russia and the Russian army. And it's so sad because, I mean, a friend of mine was telling me that, you know, like there's a couple Russian soldiers that, you know, were going to this, you know, Protestant church. And they got called to, you know, go to exercises, you know, military exercises somewhere. And then they got the night before the invasion, their commanders said, hey, we're taking your phones. Tomorrow we're invading. You know, like you're not gonna be able to talk to anyone. Cause like they literally took their phones away so that the Russian leadership can tell the people of Russia whatever they want to tell them. And there's no military member that can call and say otherwise, you know. But now Russians are stealing Ukrainians' phones, calling home. The people they're stealing their phones from are telling the government, the Ukrainian government, so they're able to tap in and hear the conversation. So you're hearing these terrible, you know, these terrible conversations. These Russians are admitting to atrocities, talking to their girlfriends, talking to their wives, talking to people back home. But they're having to steal cell phones because literally they got them their own taken away. Like that's how much Russia wants to control, like the information that's fed to their people. Like it's so brutal, dude. And what makes me sick is that there's some people that think that Russia is at the, like that Russia is in the right and Ukraine is in the wrong. When I'm thinking, like, if a government is doing these things to its people, there's no way that that government is in the right. Like if the government has to hide what's actually happening to its people and block Facebook and Instagram, like there's no way that, like, how could you think that that government or that country is actually like in the right? I don't know. Totally. To me, it seems obvious, but like you said, people have cognitive blind spots, and it's a sad reality of the world that we live in, that people create their own, you know, cognitive bubbles on the internet. And it's sad. I mean, it's not just something we experience here. Of course, it's something we experience, you know.
But this one seems like it is like one of those times where everybody does just see it and go, well, what? Like maybe it's because we share so much information through Twitter and podcasts and whatever else. It's just like, yeah, it seems ridiculous. Like, or Putin's obviously a particularly extreme screwed up situation. But it's just like that. Whatever stuff you've heard about Russia before, it's the same type of corruption problems with this system and then this particular individual. So it seems like everybody kind of gets it. Was Ukraine politically? I mean, feels very unified within the country. Was it always unified, or did they have their own like left right thing? Did that come together? How did the dynamics inside of the territory change, if at all?
Oh, it definitely did. So it's really funny. At the last presidential elections, a comedian named Zelensky started, you know, decided he's going to president, and it's actually maybe, but he actually played on a TV show job. Like that's like a TV show. That's like he plays a TV show where he becomes president, and then he actually runs for president of Ukraine, and like gets very like went and wins. He's now the president of Ukraine. And he's just, you know, probably the most, one of the most popular actors, if not the most popular Ukrainian actor. And he beats out the former, like the incumbent president, who was widely popular, at least in our city of Lviv. And probably, you know, if you asked some of our friends or the average Ukrainian a couple months before the war, what they thought of Zelensky, I mean, they probably would have told you that they didn't like him. And a couple days, you know, 2 weeks into the war, they absolutely adore him. Like, and we all do. Man, he has, I mean, he has such incredible charisma. And just, hey, I mean, he has, you know, I think I heard somebody say that he's kind of weaponized language. Like, he puts out videos every day. He has speeches every day, powerful, powerful speeches. And then he, you know, he's a native Russian speaker, ironically. And, you know, Putin is talking about denazifying Ukraine. Well, Zelensky's actually Jewish. And so it's just all like, you know, the things Putin says is we want to protect Russian speakers. We want to kill the Nazis. It's like, well, Zelensky's a native Russian speaker and
Jewish.
A Jew. So it's like, so it's just all very, yeah, it's very mind boggling. But anyways, but he actually will speak to Russians in Russian. Like he'll be doing the speech and he'll switch into Russian and be like, hey, like, this is what your country's doing to ours. You know, like this is, so he has just brought, he has galvanized the Ukrainian people in a way that has just been so powerful. I mean, I think, and you know, he's had speeches to Congress, you know, the American Congress, he's had speeches to the European Union, and they are so powerful. I mean, he has really galvanized not just Ukrainians, but I think he's galvanized all of Europe. He's galvanized the Western world. And he is communicating in such a powerful way that it's actually spurring people to action. I remember reading, you know, kind of some Congress people's response after Zelensky, you know, kind of did his speech to American Congress. And people were like, after a speech like that, we have to do something. Like we got it, you know, like he is just like, he speaks and his words carry such weight, such power. So to answer your question, it has definitely changed. Like it is galvanized. Like, you know, I think Putin, I think had a lot of his goals were to, he wanted to destabilize and like split the Ukrainian people, you know, and kind of say like, oh, there's half Ukraine, you know, this part of Ukraine speaks Russian as their first language. This part of Ukraine speaks Ukrainian as their first language. Let's do everything we can to divide those people. And, oh, NATO and the European Union and Europe is kind of, they're kind of divided right now. And America is not whatever, you know, let's try to do everything we can to divide them even more and to get America out. And it's just the opposite effect has happened. And I think in large part to Zelensky and his really powerful leadership and just courage, you know,
Is he just have charisma? That's what I'm always wondering. It's like charisma is awesome, but it can be, and we see it in Christianity all the time. It's just so easy for the charismatic people to just play people. And in this case, I mean, he's doing great stuff regardless, but is he authentic, do you think, too?
Yeah.
And that's what really matters.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember early on, you know, reading an article kind of about a journalist that had kind of followed Zelensky for a while and had talked about how, you know, it kind of asked that same question. Like, he went to the front lines of the East and this journalist went with him. Zelensky was there and, they kind of stopped and they were like, you know, we probably shouldn't go any further, you know, President Zelensky. And he's like, well, do we have more guys? Like, more guys down there? And they're like, well, yeah, it's like the front line. He's like, well, I can't let them not go see them. I can't let them like come back here and hear the president was there and didn't come see him, you know, like, so, and I would assume that is genuine. Like you don't put yourself into danger just for the sake of like a correct charismatic moment. I mean, I don't know. And even, you know, like some of his lines, you know, early on in the war, like day three, I think, like America offered him offered to evacuate him. And one of his famous lines was, you know, "I don't need a ride. I need ammo." Yeah. You know, he has
that plays. That's for sure.
It plays. It does. And it's, you know, it's on shirts now and everything. Yeah. But so I would say, you know, it's a legitimate question, because sometimes charisma can seem disingenuous, but some of my favorite videos of his are, I remember early on, you know, people were trying to spread a rumor that he had fled the country, and he just, you know, went out on the street, like outside in the streets of Kyiv with his phone, just filmed a selfie video. He's like, "Hey, I've heard people are saying I left. I have it." You know, it's just, you know, it's like a 30-second video. But just
that's
like,
interactive and responsive and awesome, and, you know, confident in what it is kind of a thing. I mean, I think it's all really fascinating, but actors and politicians, like, well, these are the best people ever at doing tricking us or whatever, you know, preachers and actors and politicians, you know.
Yeah, and they want the attention, right?
But a lot of them aren't brave. Like, you can, even if you're not the most authentic person ever or whatever it is, or you're motivated by whatever else, or you have other bad qualities, you know, bravery is one you can't really fake, and courage, like, it seems like he actually does have real backbone and that kind of thing, at least. So anyway, I find that all just interesting, you know, leaders and lead singers and all, you know, preachers, like that territory of how humans and, you know, all that's fascinating stuff, and
it really is, man,
related in a weird way.
It is. And I really do believe that, you know, that Zelensky will go down in history as a powerful voice, you know, that really said things that changed the world, you know, and said things that actually inspired people to action. And that's not necessarily, like, there's a lot of people that can inspire people to action, but in wartime, when his life is on the line and he's, you know, on the hit list, like, they want him gone so they can install another, you know, puppet president, to be able to hold on and actually, and not just hold on, but it's just like, it's like, he's made for this, you know. It's like, he's actually, this was why, you know, he was elected. It's like, you know what I mean? It's incredible. It's inspiring to, even for me, like, you know, watching his videos just inspires me, and I'm not Ukrainian, like, but it's powerful. It's so powerful.
Yeah. Everybody can relate. I mean, that's the thing, I guess, with, you know, that's what everybody's trying to do, is relate or connect or whatever. And so it's a lot of, we can feel the juice when everybody's connecting to the same thing at the same time. No doubt about that. How's this going to go down from your point of view? Like, what are we really looking at and in for? How's it going to look for you going forward? Like, what's the prediction on a practical level? Not like, you know, the future, but.
Sure. You know, it's sad, you know, even before this kind of massive escalation, you know, I'd always tell people without, you know, we would get a lot of texts and a lot of calls, you know, even before all this happened, kind of when stuff was starting to look dicey. But I would always say, I don't think he'll do anything crazy, but he is crazy, at least a little bit. Like, I believe he's got to be at least a little bit insane. He's been isolated for so long that you can't logically predict what he will do. So that's, unfortunately, the sad truth of it now, is that, you know, it looks like, by the grace of God, it looks like Ukraine won the Battle of Kyiv, and the Russian forces have had to retreat to, and they're now saying, oh, it was our intention all along. We just wanted the Southeast territories, you know. But now, I mean, you know, I talked to one of our coworkers, Nadia, and she said, like, she has family friends that live in the occupied territory that was formerly Ukraine, but got kind of taken by Russia. And those people have said now they're seeing more tech than they've ever seen in the last 8 years, like getting ready to kind of do another wave of invasion just in Southeast Ukraine. So unfortunately, you know, this could get drawn on for a while. I think for us, practically speaking, I mean, we want to go home, you know, like we want to go home to Lviv. We want to be home. We want to be with our local church. We want to be with our friends, you know, but obviously, like, you know, just yesterday, there was air raid sirens, and there was reports that, you know, like Lviv was there was missiles shot at Lviv. Thankfully, the air defense system shot them down, like was able to destroy them before they landed. But it's still not necessarily like a safe place for, you know, to raise a couple young girls. So
you're going back to do something. I'm curious what that is, but you don't have the, you're not for the foreseeable future. You're not planning on resuming that.
Well, that's the thing, man. Like back in 2014, you know, we were talking to one of the, so kind of what we're doing now is, you know, we're sending in humanitarian aid. And what's incredible is that we, you know, our organization, even though it's relatively small, we work with over 100 different churches inside of Ukraine. And so it's been incredible to, like, our little, you know, we'll send in a couple tons of aid on a bus, you know, let's say on Monday. It gets to Ukraine Monday evening. It gets to Lviv Monday evening. And then it gets put on vans Tuesday morning. It gets to central Ukraine by Tuesday afternoon. And it's already in the hardest hit cities, you know, 72 hours after we sent it in. And some of the big organizations can't do that because they're on big trucks or whatever. And then we get Ukrainians out. And Ukrainians, a lot of the Ukrainians now are coming from the farther eastern countries that are, you know, now under grave danger. Like even up to this point, the Ukrainian government had never like recommended or told anyone to evacuate. Like they weren't against people evacuating, but they had never come out and said, hey, you guys should evacuate. But now they're telling people in Kharkiv, northeast Ukraine, they're telling people in southeast Ukraine to get out. They're saying like, you need to evacuate now. Because I think they're seeing satellite imagery of all the what Russia is preparing. So those people come and they tell us stories from 2014, the initial invasion. And they tell us stories that just one day, the army dropped their weapons and left and went back to behind the front line or whatever. And so, like, as it is right now, if it stays the way it is now, you know, who knows? Like, we want to go back, you know, if we could, we want to go back today, you know, tomorrow. But as it is now, it's still not, I mean, no city in Ukraine is totally safe. Like Lviv and Western Ukraine, even Central Ukraine is safer now because the Russian army has retreated. They're still bombing, you know? And so we're praying that what happened in 2014 would happen again, that there would just be, people would drop their weapons and get out and leave, and that it would just be as fast as everything kind of started, that it would end that fast, you know? And that's our prayer. You know, we believe God can do that. And so that's what we're praying. We're praying that it would just be the same thing that these people are from the east of Ukraine telling us these stories of, you know, in their town, they just see Russia and just like drop everything and leave and go back. So we're praying the same would happen. So sadly, it's impossibly difficult to predict. But I'm going in tomorrow. I had the opportunity to go in. We have some teammates that are driving humanitarian aid to essentially like really, really close to the front line and giving it to churches that are there, and they're distributing it to people. Because there's, in those parts of the country, there's no gas, there's no water, there's no electricity. There's nothing. Like there's no food in grocery stores. There's no medicine in pharmacies. So we're sending in aid.
Basic
and now stuff, we're actually sending in semi trucks to central Ukraine that's being dispersed even quicker now. But we're taking in body armor and helmets for those drivers. So it's like, yeah, it's this weird, morbid, like,
yeah, that is,
you know, we're trying to give our friends like something that'll help maybe if something were to happen, keep them alive, you know. So
wow,
yeah, it's pretty insane. So and our so half of our team stayed in Ukraine, and our team is kind of made up of about, there's more Ukrainians on our team than there are foreigners, but we have a handful of Americans, a Czech family, and then a bunch of Ukrainian staff. So half of our team stayed in Ukraine, half of our team evacuated, and it's a mix. There's Americans, our Czech family, and several Ukrainians that have evacuated. But then there's a bunch of Ukrainians that stayed. So those, that group of Ukrainians that stayed is going to be meeting, having a meeting just to talk about, just to talk how things are going, but also to talk about, you know, kind of our strategy to continue to help Ukraine and help Ukrainians. And so I'll also be a part of that meeting. And I'm really looking forward to seeing my friends and just getting to, you know, getting to hug them, getting to talk face to face again. By the grace of God, you know, we have technology, we can talk over the phone and whatnot, but there's nothing like being together, you know? So it'll be a really sweet time. And we have some gifts we're going to bring in, just some small things, just to, you know, just to say we love them. And, so I'm really looking forward to that trip and, just getting to go to church on Sunday and hopefully I'm be doing sound for, some of my friends are playing in the band. So I love doing sound for them when they play. So that's one of the ways I volunteer at our local church is behind the soundboard. So
sounds like you've been doing the same stuff your whole life and just escalating. Yeah. You've been just, you know what I mean, at the different levels and higher stakes. I mean, it's church sound and the war
zone. I know, exactly. It's like funny, man. It's funny. Yeah, and you know, drum teaching, you know, teenagers.
Right. I mean, it makes me sad to think about the school and that stuff. You know, you'll be in our thoughts, and I'm sure people will want to check out that school. That just has my mind going. Just that is just the idea of, you know, doing that. So it just sounds amazing. You painted such a good picture of, you know, tremendous landscapes. It's really easy to latch on and feel like I have a much better grip without even having to talk about, you know, politics or war or anything, you know, news-like stuff. So, you know, this has been a terrific conversation. I don't know if there's any other messages you have or information that is productive to share or anything else, but I just, you know, thank you so much. I heard a bunch of stuff that, so I know this much, they're Ukrainians love freedom and heavy rock and roll. And I think I heard there was a McDonald's in there. So I think Ukrainian sounds like a good place to me.
In the last couple of years, you know, Lviv has gotten a KFC, has gotten a Domino's.
I just need McDonald's. There's some flavors
of home, you know, so my parents franchise Burger King. So I haven't really been allowed to like McDonald's for most of my life, but fortunately there's no Burger King in Ukraine yet. So our kids enjoy a Happy Meal. So.
Well, thank you, Lee.
But yeah, man, thank you for having me. And, you know, it's a real gift, obviously, you know, you know, it's funny because this is like, I haven't done press in a long time and it's just fun to be able to share what God's doing. You know, God's moving in Ukraine, even amidst war and amidst crisis. And it's something that is, I mean, amidst the pain, you know, that and death and just evil, you know, our team is doing everything we can to just be a light amidst that. And, it's really sad because it doesn't have to be that way. You know, there doesn't have to be darkness, but there is, you know, in this world. And so I'm grateful that, you know, that you connected with me and that we got to have a conversation and got to share with you about, you know, God's moving in Ukraine and what God and what, what's going on. And hopefully provide a voice for Ukraine and this little niche of our world here.
Well, there, you know, all your website or josiahventure.com, if they find you, I'll put the link in there. You have a support, you know, by giving there. And we certainly feel that supporting you would, we understand what, you know, exactly what it's going to and all that. So if anybody wants to check out Lee on Josiah and Josiah Venture, please do so. And is your last name, do you say it, Humarian or Hugh Marion?
Hugh Marion.
Okay.
Yeah. So my dad is actually Eastern European. He was born in Romania and so he's got Armenian ancestry. So it's weirdly like Eastern Europe has been in my blood. Never thought I'd move here, but here I am. So, Hugh Marion, Lee Hugh Marion. And yeah, josiahventure.com/Hugh Marion. It's kind of our little basic bio explains what we normally do. And it also has a little asterisk at the bottom that says what we're doing now during the time of the war. But yeah, honestly, Silent Planet did a fundraiser for Just Adventure Ukraine Crisis Fund. I mean, I know the boys in Phineas obviously gonna put something out there, but I can assure people, like, I don't know, there's been some weird news about the International Assembly or Committee of Red Cross. It's weird stuff, but I know that this money that's given to our JV Ukraine Crisis Fund is helping Ukrainians. And it's all to help Ukraine, to help Ukrainians. And, we're not the biggest organization. We're not a humanitarian organization. We're a youth ministry organization. But, kind of like the Good Samaritan, right? I mean, in that story, like the Levite and the priest, like, pass by the person in need. But the Good Samaritan sees not what he's on the road to do, but he sees a need. He stops and he helps and he gives his time. He gives his money. Like, that's what, even though our organization is not a humanitarian organization, we see the need and we're trying to act as quickly as we can to help as many people as we possibly can. So yeah, thank you for sharing that and see what God has for the coming days and weeks and months, but hopefully peace will be seen shortly.
Yeah, well, I'm happy. We're all happy you're safe, and glad that people can listen to this and catch up that know you or haven't heard from you or you aren't able to catch up with. So hopefully that'll be useful to them. So thank you for spending the time, and I'm glad we got decent internet and everything's pretty amazing. So
praise the Lord, man. Thank you, Matt, for having me.
All right.
Thank you, Labeled Podcast. Great.